When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. As you know, Michael Walker recently suffered a stroke and has been in rehabilitation. I've been blessed to have a number of most excellent guest co-hosts, and our co-host this week, correct me if I get the pronunciation wrong, is Hamhawk Philip Shabadoo.
Yo! It's Hamhawk here. We're going to talk about some games.
Yes, we are finally...
Brother.
We are finally transitioning to our drive time sports radio format. We have all the sound effects and misogynistic comments all ready to go. Thank you for this new editorial direction, Hamhawk. It's a pleasure to have you.
Yes, I have returned from the land of the hospital. It was a great stay. I am glad to be back. Like I said earlier to our patrons, a lot of pent-up podcast energy here. So I apologize if it goes off silly. And if I make any comments that are disparaging to other stroke victims or family members that have had a stroke, I understand that I have been very, very lucky in my journey so far. And so I apologize if I cause any sort of trauma to anyone.
Walker processes healing through humor, and he has been amply exercising what I could best describe as stroke privilege over the course of the past few weeks. But I don't think anyone will begrudge you for that. So welcome back, Michael Walker. People have been missing you a great deal.
I would like to thank all of the listeners who sent in well wishes. It was very helpful, so thank you very much for that. And I also like to thank the guests that came on for the last few weeks that stepped into my place, or attempted to anyway.
And here we go.
So thank you very much for that. And now we're going to talk about some board games.
Fancy that. We're going to talk about the game we reviewed a year ago in the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, The Aeurus. We're going to talk about the games we played last week, although in Walker's case, it's going to be a little bit longer than last week because I think it was roughly 12 hours after the incident where Walker's like, yeah, so we playing something or what? We're going to talk about some news and why it doesn't matter. And then our topic this week, which I have decided to entitle Michael Walker Revolutionizes the Field of Physical Therapy.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about games that we feel as though would help stroke victims and or dementia and Alzheimer's. A lot of related cross references there, but more about that later. Mark, 1 year ago exactly today, we reviewed a game called Oak by the late, unfortunately, the late distributor Game Brewer.
Yeah, it's too bad. Game Brewer was a nice publisher. We liked a lot of their output. And this was designed by Wim Goossens. We had an opportunity to talk about it a few weeks ago. Because Huey has been introducing it to all manner of different groups. It's weird. It seems to be far more approachable in terms of rules load than I would have expected, based on the number of different people that have really taken to it. For example, not that this is necessarily characteristic of much of anything, but Louis is a huge fan of Oak, and Euros are typically not his thing. And there's a lot of interacting subsystems, but at the end of the day, apparently it's just one of those things where comparative non-Euro hobbyists find it easier to get into, which is, I find, rather surprising.
You get to dress up your meeples, Mark.
Yes, you get to dress up your meeples, absolutely.
So in Oak, you're sending out all your druids to different areas, and that's going to help you activate certain actions, and it's also a hand management because you have to pair the worker placement with a card from your hand, and you can build that hand up. So a little bit of hand management or hand building, but fantastic. It stayed in the collection, and I think it will stay permanently in the collection. That is Oak.
Yes, it's been in regular rotation since we reviewed it, and it is absolutely a very good spin on worker placement, and you get to dress up your workers. That is Oak by Wim Goossens of, as Walker says, the late great Game Brewer. Now on to the games we played last week. Walker, what have you been playing?
Well, I seem to have a lot of free time on my hands and nobody around. I'm not sure why. So I played a bunch of a game called Friday from Friedman Freeze, put out by 2F Spiel. And this is a solo game where you are playing. And I never actually read the intro merc for this game. It's very funny. So you're Friday. You're right. On an island. Everything's great. Then this idiot stick.
Yes.
Robinson Crusoe shows up and starts messing everything up.
He smells bad. He doesn't know what he's doing.
He's going to get himself killed. And you don't want to be responsible for that.
Yeah.
So you are just doing the best you can to get him the hell off your island. Hilarious.
Yes.
So it is a very interesting game of, I don't even know what to call it, deck shedding or hand shedding. You're trying to get rid of the bad. You have a big mitt of fairly crappy cards. And then the good cards start cycling in that you have to defeat. In order to get them into your hand, you need to defeat them. And sometimes when you fail, that's what lets you get rid of the bad cards. So it's a very interesting sort of, when am I going to get rid of these bad cards? When am I going to, you know, take the sacrifice and get these better cards? And you need to get that cycle going just right so you can, you know, destroy the pirate ship at the end of the game. You're exploring the island. You're defeating beasts. You're doing all these different things to improve your deck.
Very few board games actually reward failure the way Friday does. Because we level up all the time in board games. We improve our decks, we improve our hands, we improve our stats. 9 times out of 10 or more, we do so through success. If you try something and you fail, you don't get any experience points. Which, if you take a step back to think about it, is batty. Because it's the other way around, really. You learn from failure, and that is something that Friday really internalizes.
Yeah, you can actively decide to fail. It's not as though it's like, oh, darn, I failed, I get this Benny. But you can actually say, okay, I want to fail just enough to get rid of these cards that happen to come up this round. It's very interesting.
And I very much appreciate Friedman Freeze's riffing on a variety of different solo designs. Some work better than others. Like Finished, I thought was a little too mechanical. And the arcade-based shoot 'em up is, I mean to try it, but it's not well regarded. Friday, though, is super clever. And as I say, the framing about evolution is almost as interesting as the framing about Friday and Robinson Crusoe is humorous. I remember that Kate Beaton of Hark a Vagrant did something similar about Robinson Crusoe and Friday. Because again, have you read any of the novel? I haven't read all of it, but the tone is just like classic colonial nonsense. You know, this idiot shows up on an island and sees some people with brown skin and assumes that they're morons and don't know what they're doing. Meanwhile, Friday's like, who's this guy? And it's just, it's really absurd. And I appreciate that Friedman Freese leans into that.
And we can segue into the other Friedman Freeze game we played this week, which was Fast Sloths. This is also put out by his own company, 2F Spiel, and yet another game in constant rotation with us because it is fantastic.
Very approachable, very light, very silly. This is, after all, the game that Huey initially dismissed as a baby game for babies. And it does have, again, somewhat humorous framing, not as much as Friday, but this is one of those cases where the humorous framing helps you remember. Just leans into how lazy sloths are. Sloths don't move unless someone moves them.
And the gameplay has nothing to do with Ethnos, but it has an Ethnos feel, whereas there are these wide variety of starter cards that you can cycle through before you decide on what subset of these cards you're going to play with, and it will completely change the game every time you play.
Absolutely. This is the first time. We've played a number of times, but we've done it with random setups every time. And this is the first time I've played with giraffes, I think, ever. And so they were very interesting. And I really, again, the thing that I like the most about Fast Sloths isn't even just the way the different powers work, although that's very nice. Trying to navigate the choke points of the map, although that too is very nice. It's the hand management. And it's done in such a way that it almost forces you to plan ahead because you cannot draw multiple cards from the same animal. And so you really have to look 2, 3, 4 turns down the line and say, okay, what am I going to need a huge run of at that time? It's like, okay, well, in about 5 turns, I'd really like to be able to make the dolphin move a lot. Okay, so start drawing those dolphin cards and wait for your opportunity. And it leads to big turns. Big turns can be fun, especially when they're not incredibly laboriously time-consuming. But just being able to zoom across the map is wonderful. You were surprised to hear that there were some expansions.
Yeah, there's two. There's like one sort of promo pack you can get, which is Chameleons, and then another sort of Christmas expansion, they called it.
Yes, so in somewhat limited distribution. I might be able to track them down. We'll see. But there's lots of content in the base game. I'm a fan of Fast Sloths. It routinely wins friends.
This game was interesting because I felt as though there was more player interaction in this particular game. The animals needed to be moved back to starting areas more than usual. I think maybe because it was less tokens. All the animals have different number of tokens that will populate the board. And so if someone takes off with the goat away from a starting or a base area, then there's no animals there. So one of the players is going to have to bring an animal back to carry their sloth. I felt that happened a lot more in this particular game.
And also the faster animal, namely the rabbits, they were mostly stuck on a peninsula because they will not cross bridges. And so there was a little bit of a choke point in that sense as well. But every setup is functional. It's not like we encountered something that seemed to degenerate. It was just, these are the interesting quirks of this particular setup, which is what you want out of a game with a variable setup like that. Fastlaw is a wonderful experience, and Friedman Freeze, he just does so many interesting things, interesting experiments, interesting riffs on things. Sometimes I wish, it's one of those things where I want creators to be different than they are. I feel this way with musicians. I feel this way with filmmakers the same way, but it's just an idle wish. Sometimes I wish he'd you know, return to the same idea and be like, huh, let me play with this hand management idea in Fastlaws. Let me play with this deck building idea in FAM. Eh, he doesn't really. He's on to the next thing. And I respect that. I really do. Not everyone wants to iterate on exactly what I want them to iterate on. But despite that, I appreciate Fastlaws for what it is. Don't let there be any misunderstanding. I absolutely appreciate it on its own terms.
And that's Fastlaths. I'm just going to go over some games I did play, but we're going to talk about at the end. Played some That's Not a Hat, but I'm sure we're going to talk about that later, so we'll just leave that till then. Ghost Blitz Mini. Mark touched on this, but I don't think he emphasized the cuteness factor of what this Ghost Blitz Mini is. It's a little tin that has, you don't have the giant wooden blocks that you
which
have,
are also cute,
which have their own appeal, but these are nice little meeples that fit in the tin, and it's all in one package. Even the rule book's circular, so it fits in the tin. All the cards are circular, and you just sort of pop the tin open, dump it out, and you shuffle the little cards, and you're ready to play Ghost Blitz Mini. It's fantastic. What a game.
Do you share my desire that there be a Cockroach Poker Mini?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like you said, there just needs to be a collection so you can have the whole set sort of in your bag. You have all these different tins. Yes. It would be amazing.
The only one I'm not interested in is Heckmeck im Bratwerkmeck, otherwise known as Pecomino. There's a mini version of that, but the joy of Pecomino is that it has these chunky bakelite tiles, and I don't think I'd want to give that up.
That's Not a Hat would work perfectly in that category.
It's true. Because it's so small, it would fit in the tin because it's not a hat.
Just so.
Yeah. I mean, any small, exclusively deck of cards game, really.
True. We also played For Sale, sort of as a closer to a thing, and never fails to please. I mean, we even had some new players. For Sale is designed by Stefan Dora and published by everyone. There is a building version, which is the most common one, and there's also a car version. And what you're doing is it's a two-phase game. In the first phase, you're buying properties. And in the second phase, you're sort of selling those properties in a way. And then you're trying to just make the most money through that purchase and sale process.
The most important question after every session of For Sale is twofold. Number one, who had the best menagerie of animals? Which is more difficult to track than it is in, say, Hyperborea, because you're not really supposed to disclose your entire portfolio at the end of the game, so I feel like I miss that all too often. And secondly, how much money did the cardboard box fetch? In this particular session, the cardboard box didn't move for very much. It was sold for $3,000. Typically, I often find that the cardboard box goes for $5,000 or more, but of course the value tends to go down the more number of players you are. For Sale scales beautifully, but when you get up to six players, as we were, turn order starts to become pretty determinative. You want to be third or fourth in the right flops or sixth in the right ones, or, you know, it can matter a lot.
And then you always have to decide at the beginning, are we going to round up or are we going to round down?
It's true. It's a whole thing.
It's a thing.
This time of course, if you phrase it, are we going to round up or round down? You then have to specify, are we taking back half rounded up? Yeah, okay, so we pay half rounded up. No. We pay half rounded down. So we're taking back rounded down? No.
Just so.
It's an issue.
That's For Sale.
Played another half game of Primal the Awakening. This is the campaign Monster Hunter or Kingdom Death Monster kind of thing by Tommaso Mandadori and Alberto Parisi.
It's a bad start. Half a game.
Yes, that is telling. One of the reasons why I'd been willing to suffer through it, well, suffer is a strong word. I'd been willing to stumble through Primal the Awakening despite my misgivings about the rules and the rules presentation is because, as I've mentioned before, the card play is pretty satisfying. And at least when we've been able to get through a session in a reasonable amount of time. After 2 hours of fighting with the giant crab thing, we were less than halfway through killing it. I looked at my watch and I said, guys, can we just call it and finish this next week? I can no more. We're going to go back. I'm going to help my friends kill the crab. And then that's it. I'm done. I just can't. I won't.
You don't have to, Mark.
Look, there's a lot of good stuff that happens in Primal the Awakening. In the case of the crab, what happens is the crab armors up in its second phase and becomes effectively immune to all damage until such time as you do a very particular set of things. And that mostly amounts to playing red cards while at the crab's rear. Now, given the way movement works, and given the way the monster AI works, this actually leads to some shocking, clever permutations. You have to remember that there's a particular monster AI card that will cause the crab to immediately turn to face you, which makes moving to its rear somewhat more difficult, you might imagine. Now, you might cooperate with your friends and have someone else expect the crab to turn to face you, which opens them up to do this thing, or you might just remember that in order to defeat that, there are a variety of ways you can counter that card. That stuff is indeed potentially clever. The problem is, in this context, it leads to drawing out the fight longer and longer and longer, which, given that there's no real hard timer involved, is not particularly satisfying. It's a game of inches to a lot. It's not super attritional. It's just that, like, for example, this crab at level 1 only ever does 1 damage at a time. And your heroes start with 9 hit points. And so, there aren't really big moments and big swings with respect to what's going on. A huge turn on the part of the heroes might be one where you do like half a wound to the monster you're fighting. And, compare that to something like Fast Sloths, compared to the other co-op games we play, like Street Masters, where you can do big turns at the end and feel like you're doing great stuff. Primal the Awakening moves at an okay clip some of the times, but anytime it starts messing with that formula or iterating on that, you get some interesting combos, but at the expense of just everything starts to draw out to a slog in some encounters. And the one with the crab is definitely being that. And additionally, I'd just like to stress, there's been a recurring feature in a number of the monster effects, and the crab has been continuing this trend, which is an awful lot of monster AI cards that are take the form do or have X or discard a card, which is not skip a turn, but it's getting close. And the crab actually lets you skip turns in some contexts. Now, you then have to remember how to defeat that skip a turn thing, and it's kind of clever, but the thing is that the or else is just unpleasant. So for every moment you get to jump on top of a plateau and then ride the boss like a big horsey and then jump off after having done a whole bunch of damage, there's also a whole lot of, oh, well, I guess my turn has been canceled because of the monster AI card. Or, I do 23 damage. Is that a wound? Nope, not even close. Or things of that nature. So, look, Primal the Awakening, I've played a lot worse in terms of monster boss battlers, and it does some cool stuff, but overall the entire package is just Kickstarter uneven and a little bit too much jank. It's not super janky, but there's just a little too much to make me go through it, especially since, again, when it comes time to campaign games, I'm mostly Game Daddy, and I want to go back to Fate Forge, and that can be the campaign that we're dealing with. I don't need Primal to be kicking around again. So it's not terrible. I've enjoyed moments of it. I just think it's an uneven package, and I'm not particularly inclined to soldier through it. So that's Primal the Awakening. If I'm lucky, I'll play it once more, and then I might be able to call it a day.
So I've seen Corporate America being played around me for the last few years, and I've always sort of shied away from it because it seemed like one of these sort of voting games where everyone wants to be the president, and it's just sort of this back and forth. And I felt it was very far from that. This is designed by Teal Fisto and put out by Nothing Sacred Games, and I very much enjoyed it. It has, you're sort of, you're sort of symbol collecting in sort of a Terraforming Mars type of way. Like I said, the gameplay has nothing to do with Terraforming Mars, but you're trying to key off these certain symbols, and you sort of want to either, you can decide, are you going to focus on one symbol and hope it comes up a lot, or are you going to diversify and sort of keep scoring every time it comes up?
So these businesses, which are all satirical in nature, have tags on them. So this might be a food business, but it might have the labor tag as well, which is to say that it's in the food industry, and anytime the food demand is generated, it's going to cash in. But by the same token, anytime there are labor problems, you're going to have issues with it. Or this might be a sin business, or this might be a technology business, or this might have the environmental tag, which means it has environmental devastation. And as Walker says, you can either try to specialize or diversify. The way that it works, and the real grist for negotiation in corporate America, is that there's a demand deck which is shuffled, and when it's your turn, you flip over a card, and you can either have that demand be activated. Again, it could be technology, it could be
food, it's a deck of these symbols.
Right. Or you can start paying to flip over more and have greater choices. And that's where the negotiation comes in. If I'm deep in food business and a food card comes up, but Walker doesn't have any food, I say, look, Walker, I'll split the money with you if you take this. Or other people might be saying, Walker, here's $2. I'll help you pay for the next card to flip up. And I really appreciate it when simple, light, fast-moving negotiation games like Corporate America give you enough structure such that it's obvious how to make deals, so you're not totally at a loss, but at the same time, enough latitude so that you can make interesting arrangements and the dynamics evolve. One of the reasons why I never suggested that you play Corporate America, Walker, is because I never really know whether the balance of structure and openness is going to be the kind that leads you to, like many other gamers, to actively engage with the deal making and get involved in the cut and thrust of offer and counteroffer, or if it's going to be like the experiences with Serial Confluence and some other negotiation games or some other social deduction games where you're just like, eh, this is a game for bullies. And I'm very glad that your reaction in this case was that you were actively involved in negotiation. As I recall, you focused a lot on sin businesses.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Look, no judgment. I'm just saying.
Yeah, and then there's going to be like sort of event cards that come up that say they affect all the different types. Like it'll be like a card came up and said, you know, if you're involved in sin, then that's bad. And then you sort of have to...
Well, these are policies that the president can enact.
Exactly.
And then there's the campaign for president, which is entirely decided by money. Again, the satire, so much satire is cringe-inducing. A lot of humor is very, very hit or miss. I have yet to have an experience playing Corporate America where people didn't look at their hand of businesses and get a chuckle or two out of some of the businesses, as well as the fact that the rule book is just utterly hilarious in terms of how it really leans into it. So the way the campaign for president is decided is it is literally about campaign contributions. Whoever gets more campaign contributions wins, which whatever. As satire goes, I don't find that particularly evocative. But if there's a tie, you send it to the Supreme Court. And who's the Supreme Court? The rulebook says the Supreme Court is anyone not involved in the game. And so I've seen this happen. You have to grab some random passerby and said, which of these people is president? At which point someone might object, hey, they're biased. They're more inclined towards whatever because you might grab someone's spouse or partner. But hey, that's how the Supreme Court apparently works.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I keep it political, Walker.
Yeah, he keeps it current.
All of this in about a 75-minute game with a very simple rule set. I think it's absolutely wonderful. It was a surprise delight because so many games that are premised on humor are just about driving that one not particularly funny joke into the ground. And it was so delightful to find that Corporate America is not only consistently funny, but it's also shockingly good as a negotiation game.
And some of those businesses have special abilities, which lets you sort of try to combo neat effects. So it keeps you in the game.
Absolutely. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm always a little bit nervous because I don't have an excellent sense about when you're going to bounce off of a negotiation game. So
that is Corporate America.
Played another game of Guards of Atlantis 2. Game of the year, Walker. Guards of Atlantis 2 is a fabulous MOBA-style game, and there's a local group that has really taken to it. And so this is the third time that they played, although this was only the second time I played with them. And this was one of those really divisive kinds of sessions where you can really tell whether Guards of Atlantis 2 is speaking to you, in that very little happened. A lot of it was about posturing. A lot of it was about feints. A lot of it was about rallying from a failed assault. In that, there was only, during the entirety of the game, there was only one player kill. And that was very early on in the game. And the rest of the game, all the assaults on other player characters were repulsed by a combination of special effects or weird cards or just having more endurance than people expected. And rather than feeling a frustrating sense of zugzwang or pointlessness, I really enjoy this kind of... Again, I'm a Guards of Atlantis 2 fan. I find that stasis in Guards of Atlantis 2 is the most fascinating stasis there is.
Was there Bear, Mark?
There was Bear. When in doubt, choose Bear.
Bear didn't kill? Bear kills.
No, no. Do you know what else Bear does? Bear spends the entire game holding off two other players all by Bear self. Nice. What happened was Bear was off to the side. I was on Team Bear. I wasn't Bear, but I was on Team Bear. And Team Bear was off to the side being harassed round after round by these same two other characters. And I kept looking over to Bear and saying, "Are you okay?" And Bear was like, "Bear, fine." And it was great. Nice. Meanwhile, we were off doing our other, again, not super effective stuff, but again, you have to come to terms with failure. Coming to terms with failure in Guards of Atlantis 2 is really, I think, the mark of a player that really appreciates its subtleties. In the game ended on the fifth push, and it literally was the case that all six players were in the middle. There were two minions left on each side, and it was a question of who could kill those two minions first. It wasn't just about initiative, though, because on our team, one player killed the first minion, another player killed the last minion, and in between, I deployed a smoke bomb to prevent the other team from getting their last minion kill. Nice. Yeah. Went down to a very cinematic-style finish. Huge fan, of course, of Guards of Atlantis 2. Looking forward to the new content. Looking forward to exploring the existing content. And this time, Walker, I decided not to take a character that was there just to ruin everyone else's day.
Well, that was nice of you, Mark.
Yes, because somehow I've achieved a reputation, I don't know how, of being unkind with less experienced Guards of Atlantis 2 players.
I don't know how that would happen.
Scurrilous libel, no doubt.
All right, so let's go from Game of the Year to ARCs. That's already been said that is Game of the Year, but we will see. So ARCs is designed by Cole Worley. It is very much a Cole Worley game and published by Leader Games. And it has a very interesting system. It is for those who have not ARC'd, it is a science fiction type game where you are jockeying for position and then you engage a scoring mechanism and hope that you can still hold that scoring mechanism by the end of the turn. And then you will score points in root style. Whoever gets to a certain threshold will win. So it's got a very interesting timing mechanism where you feel as though you have one of the scoring opportunities. So you want to engage it quickly, because if someone else does, it sort of scales down and say it's 5-4-3-2-1, say. It doesn't really matter, because the first one to do it will get first one to engage. That particular scoring opportunity will be 5 points. And then you just go down from that. So the opportunity to get it out faster is there.
And there's only 3 tokens all told. And the tokens can double up. Once the 3 scoring conditions have been activated, no one else can activate any scoring. So you have to seize that initiative when you can. At least one feels that way.
And now the faster it comes out, the more chances for it to switch back and forth become available, which sort of leads to a deteriorating game state, I feel.
Yeah, okay, let me contrast 2 different kinds of scenarios in ARCs, because I still don't know what to make of ARCs, but I'm leaning towards the negative. The way you claim cards is you put out agents on the cards, and then you do a secure action to claim a card that has more of your agents than anyone else. Crucially, though, the influence action that allows you to put the agents out is triggered in a different way from the secure action that actually lets you claim the cards. This is not true with battles. Moving your ships into position and fighting with those ships are located on the same cards and thus are triggered in the same way. And what happened in our last game of ARCs, I don't know how common this is. I've only played ARCs 3 times. I don't know how intentional this is. But the game was determined entirely by the fact that the resources necessary to secure large quantities of points changed hands 3 times in rapid succession. Because in turn order, everyone moved and then stole. And the next player moved and then stole from the one that done stole. And then everyone moved and then stole from the one that done stole. And this has nothing to do with A and B fight C wins. This isn't because they'd been softened up. This isn't because they had expended resources to go get it, although they had. This is exclusively because your ability to defend yourself against having things stolen from you is minimal. If someone's willing to eat the damage, there's practically no way to guarantee safety. And that would be fine, again, if it were slightly, I feel, if it were slightly more attenuated, if it were slightly more about setting things up for things to happen later, rather than just bang, 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 3 exchanges happen, I'm the last one standing, oh, look, I score the points. And yeah, that's not satisfying to me.
So it seems as though I was feeling like in the early rounds, it might be beneficial to go early because it allows you to engage those scoring opportunities. And then near the end of the round, go later, because if you're the last one to steal, then you get to score it.
Yep.
That seems like fun. I got to go last, so I get to win.
Especially since you have no control over when you go last. You have the ability to seize the initiative to go first, and that's fine. And I even like the fact that the victory conditions you can engage are driven by your hand of cards. And sometimes the one that you're predisposed to by virtue of the toys you've acquired in previous rounds aren't available on your cards, and so you can't declare them. That limitation I'm okay with. But ultimately, the I guess it's overly chaotic and dynamic. Dynamic not in a way that I find satisfying. I just wish there was a way to defend yourself slightly better. Like if you're in a position where you have the things you need to score points, you've done the work. You've done declared the initiative. You've done declared the ambition so that you can trigger the scoring condition. You've won and bought the toys that you need in order to score the thing. I'm not saying that you should be able to put yourself into a position of invincibility, but we discovered that you're always just one combat away from having everything taken from
you. Because it's a double sweep.
Yeah.
You lose it, they gain it.
So absolutely.
I
found it frustrating and unsatisfying. I mean, not just when it was happening to me, but also when it was happening to other people. And again, I don't know how common this is, but it seems to be an intentional part of the battle design, which is unfortunate because the rest of the battle design I really like. The attacker chooses dice based on what they want to do and how much risk they want to suffer. And they roll, and only they make the decisions. It's quickly adjudicated. It leads to interesting different textures of results. And I think it's really, really well done. But the way that it interacts with the theft and the turn order, I find unsatisfying to the extreme.
The last game we played, I had some interesting things going on where I could not get the cards I wanted to engage the scoring mechanisms that I wanted. But then there are the fancy cards that you can earn that, you know, will play around with that will let you engage scoring things. And I thought that was awesome. You know, if I do this, this, and this, then I'll still be able to do it, even though I didn't have the cards. So I do this, and then I do this, and there's no scoring opportunities left. It's gone now. You know, this three-step process that, you know, bypasses what you need to do is semi-pointless.
So, you found the restriction on declaring ambitions frustrating. I didn't, but I'm willing to accept that in the context of a Cole Whirly game, there's going to be a certain amount of pivoting that you're going to be forced to do by virtue of either the exigencies of the table or the cards you draw or both. That part I was okay with, but I respect the fact that you weren't. I can completely understand that.
I'm wondering if the strategy is just to hold back, let other people expend the resources to engage the scoring opportunities, and then as soon as they do, just work the rest of the turn in order to take them away from them.
It could be. I don't know. I mean, I will say that the fact that I'm still curious about whether this is a common experience, what could be done to mitigate that, things I could have done differently. That's definitely a tribute to the fact that Cole Whirly always makes interesting systems. It's just often they're not for me.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. Maybe that's just the feeling he wanted, this sort of back and forth, take that sort of feel.
Yeah. Arcs.
Arcs.
Arcs. I want to emphasize, I'm still miles away from feeling like I'm in a position to play the campaign version because it introduces a whole bunch of new rules. And I don't think we're there yet. I don't know if we're going to get there. We'll see.
So Mark's talked a lot about Slay the Spire, the board game. I played it a bunch. We're about to finish our first sort of game. We've done two acts. So I won't say too much about it. I play a lot of the computer game. And I just found the one thing that is slightly different is Mark had said, they scaled back the damage. You start off, most things do one damage. And what is a little off-putting is the fact that when you upgrade it or improve it, it does one extra damage. So in reality, doubling the damage, where in the card game, that is usually not the case. It usually goes like from four to six, or it doesn't double it. So the incentive to upgrade the cards is far, far greater in the board game than it is in the computer game, I felt.
Huh. Well, it depends on what you're upgrading and why, right? If it's a card that already does three, it often upgrades so then it does four.
True.
Right? The basic stuff that only does one, yes, if the upgrade gives it more damage, it'll typically go from one to two. But sometimes the upgrade doesn't just increase the damage. Sometimes it increases another effect of the card. Sometimes it makes it cost less energy and be easier to play. Who knows? I have not felt that strong impetus to upgrade any more so than the than the PC game. If anything, sometimes I feel less of an impetus upgrade because the character I typically play, the Silent, one of the key upgrades that you can have in the computer game is something called Innate, which is you start each combat with that card in hand. That is one of the features that had to have been stripped away from the card game. There are no innate cards anymore. It's an absent keyword. And so the upgrades work on a different path. And so consequently, I found playing as the Silent, I am actually playing suboptimally because I'm building my cards and my deck and my approach around powers that are not innate anymore, right? There's a certain reliability in the PC game. It's like, I know I'm going to start with these. Okay, so I can set this up for future rounds. And so I know that my Shiv, I'm going to get a bonus Shiv every turn, and it's going to do extra damage because these are innate cards. But in the card game, it's like, maybe it'll show up in time, maybe it won't. Oh, your deck is too fat. Nice try. Whereas in the PC game, it'll work all the time.
I'm enjoying the fact that they haven't really introduced new cards. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like new stuff. They've taken everything from the game and just sort of manipulated it in a way. And I find it interesting just to see how they've done that manipulation. And the clever ways that they've changed the cards in order to fit into the game. I'm very much enjoying Slay the Spire and can't wait to play more.
I'm glad. My dear friend Josephus was in town from New England, and so we played Combat Commander, as we often do. This is a game we play routinely. I'd just like to say for the record, I've commented on this through the years. And I've been of this opinion ever since I started hobbyist gaming. So even back when I started playing Dungeons & Dragons when I was 12, I do not believe, flatly, that some people are luckier at dice rolls than others. I find especially tabletop role players get very, very superstitious with dice and very, very superstitious. You know, they have to rub the die against a certain thing. And then once it starts rolling badly, they swap it out for a different die and nonsense like that.
Mark,
yes.
They sell dice jails. Online. Have you seen them?
I have not seen the dice jail.
This is something you can buy.
Okay.
It's called the dice jail. So when your dice are bad,
yeah,
you can put them in the dice jail.
Now I'm sad. But anyway, that having been said, Josephus' luck in Combat Commander is truly miserable. Now, there are sometimes he makes decisions, and those are not the calls that I would have made, and I sometimes feel comfortable even believing to myself that they were mistakes, and he might pay for them later. But oh my goodness, he cannot win for all the losing in Combat Commander. The deck just seems to punch him in the face over and over and over again. That having been said, Combat Commander, one of the things that differentiates it from the hordes of other squad-based World War II games, is that really interesting stuff happens all the time. It's got a lot of narrative to it. It's got a lot of texture to it. And so even when I'm losing terribly, I enjoy watching the sweep of what's going on in Combat Commander. It's supremely well done by the late, great Chad Jensen. But one aspect of the rules design has been true since inception. It was slightly improved upon in Combat Commander Pacific, but this playing really emphasized it again. And that is that firepower in Combat Commander is very awkwardly rendered. It is impossible to eliminate a unit on a fire attack. All that you can do is break them. And if you break a broken unit, then they're eliminated. But the problem is, it's very difficult. When you do it, it's satisfying, but it's very difficult to break and then eliminate the same unit in the same turn. Doesn't matter how big your fire team is. You can load up all the guns of the Western Front onto the same unit, and they're just all they're going to do is break, and then your opponent can just play a recover card, and then they're back, because recover cards are almost guaranteed to recover units, especially if they're of any decent quality and or if they're in cover. It's kind of the price of admission. I respect the fact that there's a lot of deck balancing going on in terms of the number of recover cards that a given nationality has and the values on the units to recover them. A lot of interesting design work went on there. The designer's notes are very interesting. But the overall dynamic can get a bit frustrating if you approach it with some sort of naive understanding that I shoot big guns, thing die. Not really. Mostly what you're going to do is buy yourself time. That's okay. So we play as per usual with the random scenario generator. And we had Anzac forces fighting German Volksgrenadiers in 1944, which is not exactly what you would call super historical. That was not the kind of matchup you would see. There were Anzac units that fought Germans, just not that late in the war. So these were line Anzac units fighting Volksgrenadiers. So you can imagine that the disparity of troop quality was considerable. And despite that, my gaming partner, Josephus, he tends to prefer what the Hanwerker would call boys before toys. If you give him the option to have a detachment or a company, he will always take the company and show up with large quantities of dudes. Meanwhile, again, counter to my normal impulses in Combat Commander, I tend to choose smaller numbers of more competent forces. And sure enough, there was a large quantity of Germans being thrown against the meat grinder that was the Anzac defense. But nonetheless, as I say, even when the firepower is somewhat awkward, even when the gaming gods themselves descend down and nudge the dice so that Josephus cannot catch a break to save his life, Combat Commander is still a great time. The variety of different combat encounters you can have, the variety of units, the narrative that emerges off of every play, I think it is an extraordinary experience and very, very approachable for non-historical wargamers. So that is more Combat Commander.
Sounds like my battle lore luck.
Look, I'm trying to keep this superstition firewalled. So don't encourage me to start generalizing it. Irrationality is catching, so I don't want to.
He also had not played Marshmallow Test before, so I definitely wanted him to try this. This is a Reiner Knizia trick-taking game by GameRight, and it's a very interesting trick-taking game where you're trying to float around this I'm almost ready to go out, but don't want to go out sort of status. Because how it works, if once you take a certain number of tricks based on the number of players, in our case it was three, as soon as you've taken three tricks, you're out of the round, and you're only going to score as many points as the other players have already taken tricks that round. So you always want to be the second player out, because if you're the last player out, you get 0 points.
Well, you want to be the second to last player.
Second to last. What did I say? Sorry. I meant second to last. And so, like I said, you're floating, trying to be the second to last. You don't want people to force you up, because that does happen. You know, you play this five, and like, oh, this won't put me out. Everyone has hard cards higher than five. Yeah. Sure enough, 4, 3, 2, 1, and there's your third trick.
It's fascinating watching people playing as though they're all playing Void just before they change gears and then want to win all the tricks. Yeah. The number of times I led like a 4 or a 5 and ended up winning the trick, and everyone else is laughing at me. That was amusing.
Also has this interesting sort of Trump breaking rule, where if you're void of a color and decide to play Trump on it, then you sort of broken the Trump seal for that particular hand. And then anyone that plays after you may also play Trump as well as the lead card if they wish.
And sure enough, the last round really goes to show why this is a well-themed trick-taking game, which is truly a rarity, even setting aside the designer, in that the scoring threshold is 40 points. I had calculated what I needed to do to get 40 points. I went out second in that particular round, got my points, thought I was going to be fine. Josephus, on the other hand, just bided his time and went out a few turns later and managed to surpass me because he delayed his gratification. It's the nature of the game.
Just so. Marshmallow Test, by far one of my favorite trick-taking games out there.
Finally, we played Wilmot's Warehouse. This is a review copy we got from CMYK Games. This is kind of sort of an adaptation of the PC game by Ricky Haggett and Richard Hogg. They're also credited as designing the board game, and David King is also a credited designer on the game. And it is billed as, and this is the thing with CMYK, I had the same vibe when they were pitching Wavelength, which is a party game they published a few years ago with Wolfgang Varsch and a number of other CMYK designers. And they said, Wavelength will make you feel like you're telepathic. I'm like, yeah, sure. And then you play it and you feel like you're telepathic. Wilmot's Warehouse sets out this challenge whereby you have 35 tiles face down in a grid that you place one by one, and you have to remember exactly where each of them are. No chance. That was absolutely my impression, and it's the impression of many people when they set it out. And it is billed as a cooperative storytelling memory game. I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. Pull the other one. It's a kind of magic. It is truly sublime in that is exactly what it does. You end up telling a story about these somewhat abstracted figures. First, you have to decide what you're going to parse the symbol as, and then work it into a narrative so that you can remember where all these things are. And the fact that it works is amazing.
Yeah, we had a fantastic story both times we played it.
Yes.
And I think we got them completely right. All 35 tiles right both times.
Yes.
And so there's no timed element. It's all sort of cooperative. I mean, like, while you're playing the game.
Right.
You start placing out the tiles. There's some very interesting daily objectives or, you know,
things that make the game harder. Yeah. You have to speak in monosyllable. After every tile placement, the board rotates 90 degrees, which you may not think is hard, but it really is.
Or things everyone like gets that. Up and changes places. All sorts of fun things like that. And then once you've placed out all 35 tiles, that's when the timing starts. There's another deck of cards that
corresponds to all the
mimics
tiles,
all of the tiles, which there are a ton. There's at least 70. There's at least double what there is on the board.
More than that, yeah. The universe of available tiles is much, much greater. So you have all these cards that might or might not be present in the actual game.
And so you divide them up into all the players evenly, and then they start going through then you start the timer, and you go through your little deck as fast as possible, placing the cards on top of where you think that tile is. And then once you're all done, you stop the timer, and then you add to the time all the ones you've got wrong, if you're bad at the game. And then whatever time you come up with has the standard rule book. Well, you got this time. Well, maybe next time try a little harder.
Well, it's not quite as pejorative as, say, the just one scoring system is in Wilmot's Warehouse. And just as an indication of the kind of stories you tell, this was up on stream, by the way, if you want to see us go through this. The first tile that we placed, we had a discussion. It could have been a snake swallowing something. Could have been a seed. We decided that it was an emo kid with blonde hair. Contradictory? I know. But that determined the overall thrust of pretty much the entirety of the tile placements, because emo kid went to a rave, emo kid met Rave Bay, Rave Bay became Pope somehow. It's a whole thing.
It was awesome.
Rave Bay for Pope.
We had emo kid's kit. It was great. It was all good.
Yeah.
How they got there, how long it took, the whole relationship between the two of them, it was magic, Mark.
I'm sincerely, the game is a kind of magic. I would like to explore slightly higher difficulty levels. There are ways to tweak that. But quite frankly, as far as an experience goes, I have no notes. It's you set out this challenge that on the face of it seems super difficult. So the fact that it turns out to be super easy isn't a huge deal as far as I'm concerned. I'm a little bit worried about how repeat plays with a lot of the same symbols are going to shake out. Because we had some tiles that were duplicated from our first experience, and that made us more comfortable with them in a way that was simultaneously helpful and unhelpful. But anyway, this is just a sort of something to wait and see. I'm very enthusiastic about Wilmot's Warehouse, and I really think that CMYK has done it again.
Yeah, it's probably more on that at the end.
Absolutely.
And those are the games we played this week.
We take a break to pay some bills.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And now, on to the news and why it doesn't matter.
All right, so there's a game coming out called Until Proven Guilty. It's a narrative cooperative game. Sounds very interesting. Same in the same line what we just talked about. Sort of storytelling, cooperative, trying to, get someone off charges. It seems like it's going to be very interesting. Right up my alley. Going to check it out. It is designed by Enrico Porcati and put out by DV Games. So, Mark, you haven't talked about the new Root expansion yet.
I haven't. No.
New Root expansion coming out. It's going to be Bats and Frogs.
Has Jenna Feli been consulted? Can you release a hobby game with frogs without Jenna Feli?
Is it going to shape up to like if they're not galactic planet-eating frogs, then okay, really,
look,
what's the point?
Obviously, you shouldn't compare any old frog to Arena.
I suppose.
They can't all be 2 mile high and be powered by a sun. I think that's a little bit unfair. Very much in the same way that it would be unfair to compare a normal human to the Hyperborean mega Chad that is Michael Walker. But I'm just saying, I'm pro-frog, but Jenna Feli has set a very, very high bar for frogs.
That's so true. In the before time, like 4 weeks ago, I talked about Planet of the Apes, the role-playing game, in the last Pledge of Indifference. Now there's going to be Planet of the Apes, the miniatures board game, where it's a cooperative game where you actually play. I thought it was going to be you play as the Marines. It's in the new.
The Marines.
Well, this is in the new Planet of the Apes.
Oh, I haven't seen the new one.
This one, neither have I. I've only seen
one. There are Marines.
There are Marines, apparently. I've only seen the very first one in the new wave.
Do they have pulse rifles?
No.
Okay.
So in this one, you actually get to play as the apes versus the Marines. So that might be interesting.
Is it a straight up fight or is it another bug hunt?
I just don't know.
How do we get that?
All I need to know, Mark, is where they and that is Planet of the Apes, the miniatures game. Mark, more Barrage. Two new companies and not a bigger box, Mark. No, no, no. A legendary box.
Right?
Yeah. So more Barrage to come. And You thought like four versions of Great Western Trail was enough? No, no, no. Need more. Great Western Trail El Paso soon to come out. So yeah, more Great Western Trail because we need more of that.
I'm looking forward to finding how they are going to butcher American geography in new and exciting ways.
And lastly, for me, I just want to thank Liege of Games because I don't want to source all my news from one spot and not give credit. So Liege of Games is another channel and he does great news spots. And so I got a lot of this news from his channel. It is League of Games.
Finally, for me, we like skirmish games and Walker's favorite skirmish system is Unmatched. He talks about all the time how he loves it. And I just want to point something out. So there's...
Just a second. Let me just see the beginning here. News and why it does matter. Talking about stuff that we're interested in. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead. Go ahead.
No. Here's why I mentioned it. Because the co-op version of Unmatched Adventures, is going to have a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles license. And it really is a sort of golden age of a revitalization of interest in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. A whole bunch of new video games, a whole bunch of new adaptations, the role-playing game is back, and all manner of other things. This is why I find it striking. I was reflecting on the fact that I am utterly unmoved by the, quite frankly, impressive licenses that Unmatched has managed to line up. Restoration Games is certainly punching above its weight class in terms of the different licenses it's had. You know, Marvel alone is pretty impressive. And
I just wish it punched above its weight set in a rule book.
Okay, yeah, moving on. And ultimately, this caused me to reflect on how I'm generally unmoved by things like Exceed and a whole bunch of other cross-license game systems. And it's like, well, why do you not like that, but you like HeroScape? For all its time-traveling weirdness, there was a weird kind of coherence and consistency to what was going on in HeroScape. I don't know. It was its own thing. It was kind of its own flavor. Consistency isn't the right word. Flavor is the word that I will use instead. Whereas the moment like Raphael and Sherlock Holmes are fighting Daredevil and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I then think you don't have your own flavor. I think you have the absence of flavor, frankly. And I guess the upshot in terms of the news results is Restoration Games continues to land impressive licenses. Too bad I don't care. And that is the news and why it doesn't matter. And now we move on to our topic, which is Michael Walker revolutionizes the field of physical therapy.
Well, first of all, I want to say we are not experts in Alzheimer's, dementia,
sure,
or stroke. I've only had one, so...
Well, they say practice makes perfect.
Just so. So take this all with a grain. We are using our board game experience.
Well, and direct experience.
And direct experience. To match up what we feel as though would be helpful games to help not only ward away dementia and stroke. Sorry, dementia and Alzheimer's. You can ward away stroke, but not with...
Well, you can help with recovery, though.
Recovery, yes.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Although, we can guarantee that if you pledge to us on Patreon, Walker will extend his magical stroke protection to you, which will reduce or not reduce your chances of stroke. We're not sure which one.
All right. So
better safe than sorry is what
I'm
getting at.
Cover all the bases.
Yeah. So why don't you start by telling us some of your experiences with some of the members of your care team?
So yeah. So when you're doing recovery, you usually have two types of therapy. You have OT, which is workplace therapy, and you have PT, which is more physical, re-strengthening everything. And the workplace is doing things that will get you back to your workplace. Like, what do you need to work on in order to do your job?
Not necessarily workplace. Like OT is occupational therapy, and occupational is understood in a very, very broad sense, right? So in your case, yes, you care about the workplace, but it's also just about rehabilitating you towards your quotidian tasks, what those happen to be, right?
Correct. So I'm looking around the workstation. I'm seeing what the other patients are doing and the activities they have me doing. And I'm thinking, man, do I have stuff that is just more interesting? I don't want to say better because I'm not. It's just different. And I think we'll hit these things and make it more interesting. So I bring in a variety of things that I think will hit all the different things, which we'll get into later. And I get halfway through showing the OT worker, the head worker there, because she had my particular file, and she just says stop. And she gets on her walkie-talkie and she calls in all of the other assistants and heads, and then I get to start the spiel again, going through the games that I was showing, and they were very impressed. They're already picking up some. They liked what I had to offer, and that's why we decided we're going to talk about this today, because there are some very interesting things going on.
So the title of the topic is Half a Joke. I would not be surprised to see you mentioned in a footnote on some research paper going forward. So what are some of the things you managed to show your care team, Walker?
All right, so start with Paku Paku. It's a variety of things. I'm going to talk about some other things very quickly. So with stroke specifically, part of your brain has died, and what happens is something called neoplasticity, where your brain reattaches all of the connections to what has been cut off. So you have to do these things over and over, even today I had a bunch of new notes because I talked to a whole different team today, where it's almost as a child, you repeat the same thing over and over again as a child, and that works those things. So that's what we're doing now in rehab. So the first one I showed was Paku Paku. You want to get games or activities that are interesting. Like, you don't want the patient to think it's exercise or work, right? So you have to be able to sell them on it so they will want to do it. And you also need something that has a wide levels. So because strokes are like snowflakes, they're arrogant, selfish. I mean, no, wait, wrong time. There is no two strokes that are the same because of the trillions of different pathways. You don't know which ones are going to be cut off. There's no two strokes are the same. So you need a game that can, play to all of those
scale
to all of those different things. So Paku Paku was there because not only is the game stacking, so it's dexterity, motor skills, grabbing the dice quickly and rolling them, but you can just sort of do the stacking as a side thing, practicing that and working on your motor skills just that way, and sort of the other way around, it's pressure, timing, getting it there. Also showed them, the big one was Jenga Maker. Mostly for that thing. They had a lot of these, the older people know what Tinker Toys are. It's like Lego or the other things, but these were all made of wood. You have these big, sort of wheels that have holes, spokes, and you build things. I saw the patients making them, and it just took them so long, right? And when you're already, I don't want to say so much in pain, but it's very frustrating and difficult, and it's taking long.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just want something that will give you, I don't want to say instant gratification, but a success.
Absolutely.
And these Jenga, and it works with Jenga Maker on many levels because you have the easy deck and the hard deck, and you can just give the person the card and say, build that. They build that and they're done. They can also play the game because now it's communication. Explain to someone how to do something, because like I said, they could have like cognitive
aphasia
disconnect. Yes. And so that works as well. The actual game will work as well.
And if I can just riff a little bit from, elaborating on your personal experience with some of my clinical experience, as well as some of the experience caring for my father and other family members as they were ill, it is incredibly dispiriting and demoralizing, especially for some groups of people, because number one, a lot of people have this assumption that, they have a memory of recovering from surgery back when they were in their 30s and they go in for something in their 50s and suddenly it takes five times as long as it did back then. That gets very dispiriting. You can get very, very dispiriting in cases of stroke or other kinds of cognitive impairments where something that you've been doing for decades now you can't do. And the frustration level can be through the roof, especially since it's very hard work and you have to keep at it and you need repetition. And all this time you have this very firm conviction that you should be back to normal by now, or why is this taking so long, or why can I not do this thing that even very young children can do? There's a thousand different reasons why it can be infantilizing and minimizing and frustrating and all these other kinds of things. And that's why I think you're absolutely right that some of these, you were talking about some of these tinker projects that people are sitting together, are elaborate and take a long time to finish. And sometimes success or very good progress is like finishing like a tenth of it, which is great from a clinical perspective, but from a patient perspective, that can be very frustrating. And so gamifying these things, having at least be, a little bit more variety that we as hobbyist gamers take for granted, can be tremendously useful in these contexts.
I feel I have other ones, but I feel the biggest one, because we talked about it a lot, is I thought about it because I didn't even have Ghost Blitz at the time.
Right.
I saw the mini one, so I got it. Because it has, it hits both. Not only dexterity, motor skills, because you have to grab that one tile or meeple from the middle of the table, yep. but it's the thought process. You have to look at the color, you have to look at the shape, and not only do you have to think about, is this the one that has the exact shape that I want, or do I have to weed out, or, because that's how, for people who don't know, GoSplits works, it either has two images. So either one of the images is the exact shape that's on the table, or none of it, like the color is not represented and the shape is not represented. So your brain has to figure out that, all right, so there's no green and there's no bottle, so that's the one I want to grab first. So GoSplits, I think, is great for that whole thing.
Yeah, pattern recognition, and it scales up immediately because you don't have to, again, like you said with Paku Paku, you don't have to have the time pressure. You don't need to do it in a real-time context, and so that can also help reduce some of that frustration element.
We already talked about Wilmot's Warehouse, because even before all that, we got this review copy way before this happened, and I was already very excited just for the dementia and Alzheimer's angle, where, and for children to learn studying skills, this association between things and teaching your mind to associate remembering things by connecting them together. I think it's a fantastic sort of experiment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Just connecting things under a narrative, forming new connections between things rather than just rote memorization is a great way to help rebuild some of the lattice work of a lot of these abilities that OT is based on.
And we played That's on Our Hat. I said, we're going to go back to that. It's yet another memory, like high level memory. Sort of, I don't want to play up like That's on Our Hat is like a crazy, you know, remember everything. It's not like, you know, Wilmot's Warehouse, we have to remember 35 things, but it is on a level of things moving around and you need to remember where things are. So it's high level memory.
I don't know, man. It's okay. First of all, just from a game design perspective, it's amazing that when I play Wilmot's Warehouse, I can remember dozens and dozens of things and where they are. But in the context of playing That's Not a Hat, I struggle to remember two things at a given time. I don't know if I would, my salient experience with That's Not a Hat is pleasant, and I enjoy it, but also frustrating and very, very tense. I don't know if I would recommend that in a clinical context in the same way.
So another activity I had to do. I don't know if you've ever seen these little tiny plastic beads. I think people like make necklaces, have these little tiny mini beads with a hole in it. But what they had me doing is using tweezers, picking up these little tiny beads and putting them on this track. And I was like, this is awfully boring. I could be doing this, or I could be playing Tinder Blocks.
Yep.
So the next day I had Tinder Blocks in there showing them, and they said, oh my God, this is way better. And so we're actually playing against people that were playing Tinder Blocks. Fantastic. So Tinder Blocks is another one that's just straight up, you know, there is a little bit of, you know, shape recognition when you look at the card and have to know which ones to pull out to build. So there's a little bit there, but it's mostly motor skills.
Absolutely. One of the things that I really appreciate, this is a little bit different. This is kind of a post-recovery situation just in terms of accessibility. And one of the biggest downsides of being such huge fans of dexterity games is most dexterity games are not very accessible. Anybody with palsy or any kind of disability that prevents them from doing these things, sometimes it can be very alienating. And again, in contexts where it's particularly unfortunate in the context of dexterity games, because typically they tend to be the most approachable from the rule set perspective. And so it's one of the things that I tend to be drawn towards most when I don't know the relative skill level of gamers, but by the same token, I'm then making assumptions about their physical capabilities, which is why I really appreciate it when designers like Eric Royce, who designed For Science, really go the extra mile and say, look, if you're playing with people that have any kind of palsy or disability or inability to stack things properly or who are ill-inclined to, those people don't have to stack. They can instead just lay things flat on the table and build their structures that way. And I wish that, very much in the same way that the community has made great strides about colorblindness. I mean, you know, 15, 20 years ago, if you were a colorblind hobby gamer, it was frequently very, very difficult. But now, the overwhelming majority, I think, of games with, you know, different cards of different colors, they tend to have various forms of symbology. And I sometimes wish that the dexterity games would kind of up their accessibility approaches in the same way. Of just, you know, a line here, just spend a little bit of time trying to imagine how you could design a game that's slightly more accessible and or issuing accommodations for people to make it more accessible.
Yeah, I did have For Science here, just because there's three different kind of puzzles going on at the same time.
Mm.
And you have the cards that modify those puzzles. And so it'd be like more for like a gamer that's in this situation.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
Or to entice them more into doing things. Or someone that's gone to a high enough level that, you know, you want to push them even further.
Right, well, that's just it. I wish that some of the more, less gamerly, less hobbyist kinds of dexterity games were more approachable for people with either disabilities or other kinds of impairments that prevent them from being able to stack or engage in that kind of fine motor control, if they were inclined. Now, maybe for a lot of the less hobbyist type dexterity games, there's not much left if you strip that away, but nonetheless.
There's a line here I missed that I definitely want to go over, because not only, you know, all these motor skills is promote, but it also promotes like social interaction. Like you're playing with someone, because a lot of these patients, sometimes they're alone.
Yep.
Or they definitely feel alone at this particular time.
It's always alienating to be in an institution like that. Yeah.
So it just, you know, it's a great motivation for that.
Absolutely. And especially in contexts where, again, if you strip out some of the more real-time elements, if it's something like Tinder Blocks, if you do something more like a turn-based Ghost Blitz, for example, turn it into a one-at-a-time sort of
junkyard. I have junkyard art, and you make it just sort of like, we're both going to build this together, right?
And absolutely.
So and games like that where you can just modify it, where they just are going to provide the pieces. Sure, you could play the game, but things that you can just sort of adapt to, you know, go as you want. So I feel finally, I think, even though I've not done any of this, but I've had experience with it, I think where this is all going to lead, I really feel as though technology is going to play the biggest role. I think AR is going to come in and make this sort of recovery thing huge, because it can sense your level, and then it can, sorry, this is not here, I'm saying in the future, this is what's going to happen. It's going to sense your level and what your limitations are.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's going to formulate a program for you for reaching, manipulating, moving, you know, cognitive, like what color is that? Where is it going?
Pattern recognition.
All of that stuff. Yeah. So it can assess it and do it for you all in like real time.
Mm.
Now, the sort of block right now is that, unfortunately, strokes happen to a lot of it's more elderly patients, unfortunately.
Yes.
And they do have a pushback against technology. So maybe that might be a hurdling block for that particular thing,
mm-hmm.
but who knows? But I feel as though the future of this is in augmented reality.
I'm not buying you a Quest 3, Walker.
Damn it.
Well, Walker, it's great to have you back. Thank you very much for sharing your experiences. It's been, I hope you do indeed have a lasting positive impact to your team. But then again, you tend to have that effect on most everybody you meet. So I'm confident you will. And that is going to do it for this, the glorious return of Michael Walker to So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you very, very much for joining us. Thank you again for your constant support over these past few weeks. We appreciate your having decided to spend the time with us, and we look forward to seeing you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.